do this. Okay. So, in the same way that we looked at the overall story of Arthur, again, in this sequence, I want to look at again Malory's version of the path to the Grail, and we'll discuss later on in the afternoon, really, the Grail is this mysterious thing. The Grail spirit certainly is a mysterious thing, so we'll come back to look at that later on. But this is specifically the account you get in the medieval stories of Arthur and in the particular version written by Malory. Malory's version is actually quite a good version also, partly because a lot of the French Norman versions, Norman French versions, have particularly the quest to Sangreal, which is where he draws his material from, have these long religious homilies, and which don't really add to anything. And Malory very helpfully just got rid of all of those. But the story begins with a knight called Balin. And Balin and his brother Balan are two knights, and interestingly, they have quite a resonance with the figures of Nissin and Evanissin from the second branch of the Mabinogi. Now, the second branch of the Mab, we'll come back to this at another point, but the second branch of the Mabinogi has a great deal to do with both of the story of Arthur and the story of the Grail. In place of the cup in the second branch of the Mabinogi, you have the cauldron but you also have these two figures, these two brothers. Now, in the Welsh tradition, Nissin is the completely good brother, and Evanissin is the wicked brother. Similarly, in this we have Balin, who is the angry knight, and was called the Knight of the Two Swords. And as the Knight of the Two Swords, and because the sword represents will, he represents that quality of divided will, splitting and separation. Whereas his brother Balan represents goodness and unity and balance. And the story begins really in the Grail Castle, Castle of the Fisher King. And Balin is attacked by one of the knights of the castle. And he pursues this knight through the castle, and he comes to the Grail Chapel where the hallows of the Grail are kept. And he encounters the Grail King, the Fisher King. And the quick Fisher King is, because he has this magical king, cast down his sword with a gesture, but then Balin seizes the Grail spear, which is said to be the spear of Longinus that pierced Christ's body on the cross, and thrusts this into the groin of the Grail King. And this first image shows us this act about to happen. So here you can see Balin. The Grail King has broken one of his swords. He has another sword at his hip. And he's seized from off the altar. He seized the sacred lance and is about to plunge it into the groin of the Grail King. Now, the particular wounding here is the wounding to fertility. We think that the Grail is about regeneration. And the and recreation. This is a wound to that very principle. But it's this quality that the Kabbalists call avon, which is not just sort of anger or resistance to life or even unconsciousness, but the misuse of the sacred. Because what's being wielded here is the sacred spear of will, the spear this which in itself is the sort of the energy of Chokmah on the tree. It's that energy of creation, that ignition energy, and here it's being used being used creatively, is being used to destroy. And it's the misuse of the sacred in the service of the kind of the self really that is really being shown here. And Berlin is this kind of very damaged kind of figure, really, with a split mind, split will, schizophrenic, I suppose we could say, but he's sort of much more than that. He's somebody who is oscillating all the time between in a sort of mad, striking out crazy kind of way. And so we can see the Grail is on the altar. The Grail King is warning him and trying to get him to stop, but he's just about to plunge the spear into the groin of the Grail King. Now, there's a very ancient Celtic tradition about the health of the king being related to the health of the land. So if the king is wounded, and certainly if he's wounded in his fertility and his capacity to create the land, this is reflected in the health and the life of the land. Now, this happens very dramatically here, and we will see in the next picture, because Balin's action is to causes the land to become wasted, like the withered orchard we encountered in the meditation, but it also causes the total collapse of the Grail Castle. And here we can see Balin with his broken sword and his other sword, and we see Merlin in his form as the Green Hermit, rescuing him out of the ruins. The Grail King is also rescued, but is wounded and is taken in every move place where he somehow lives between life and death. Now, the place of the Grail King is the place we encounter really in the Corpus Christi Carol, where he is wounded. He lives between life and death, and yet the life flowing from him still sustains the worlds. But here we have Merlin intervening and helping him, because Merlin is into, because in a certain sense, this is again one of these necessary things, the destruction that leads to recreation. And, without this initial apparently appalling act of Berlin, the rest of the Grail story cannot happen. So Balin then goes off and has a number of adventures, and we have, but a particular thing that then happens is he encounters his brother. So we have Balin on the left, his brother Balan on the right, and Balan is in red armor, and this is the kind of armor so we see here the opposites again, the white and the red, the blood and the water. But these are the opposites not working together. These are the opposites in conflict. And both of the brothers, the good and the bad, carry two swords, because that emphasizes again the duality, the opposites unresolved, being unresolved. And they're on a bridge before a great castle. And normally, opposites, when resolved, create a bridge, create a way into new possibilities. But here, the only bridging is into death, because actually, what happens is that both are killed. And so, the next thing that we see is we see the entombment of Balin and Balan buried in the same grave. But something has happened in this process, because now we see them with just a single sword each. But the other sword, the sword of separation, is being placed in a block of red marble by Merlin. So this is really that this place in the Kabbalah where you talk, where you take the things that have become distorted and bind them into the service of life. Because this later will become the sword of Galahad, the first sword of Galahad anyway. And so if you just look at this image for a moment, you see the two brothers at peace. Instead of now being split into good and evil, white and red, day and night, there is a sense of rest. Yeah. And we see Merlin gathering up the instrument of disturbance and placing it in the hollow of the stone. So uniting the sword and the stone. So this, in a sense, forms the backstory to the part of the backstory of the Mallory Grail story, because this is all part of the ruination of Logres and the way in which the kingdom has no law, has no balance, the principles of life and light and love and law are not regarded, and because it's all a wilderness with everyone for themselves. Now, we jump forward quite a long way now to the establishment of Camelot and we come to the figure of Elaine of Corbenac, who is a great enchantress and who is the daughter of the Grail King that we saw in the first image. And she's looking into her magical mirror and she sees the figure of Lancelot in the mirror coming in through the forest. If you notice Lancelot's shield, these are the classic arms of Lancelot, which are silver and red, or white and red, diagonal bars, which reflect the water and the blood, the two roses, and the blood and the tears, that these two energies of manifestation that we've been looking at. And the beginning of this story, really, between Lancelot and Elaine, is the creation, so this place where in Camelot, if you like, the desire nature, the ability to bring the energies right down to earth has been blocked, but there's still a need for the new magical child, who is the antithesis of Mordred, to appear. But of course, the great distortion that you find running through the Arthurian myth is that magical child should have been the child of Arthur and Guinevere, and should have been the next in the succession, so that Camelot would not fall. Now what's happening is that magical child is happening between Lancelot and Elaine, and therefore not a king, and therefore not somebody who can rule. And so you see that quality still manifests in the world, but is in a certain sense displaced. It's taken in a slightly different direction. Now the figure of Elaine is sometimes confused with another Elaine, who is the fair maiden of Astolat, who falls in love with Lancelot and who has an unrequited love, and the pre-Raphaelites have produced a number of images of the fair maiden of Lancelot of Ascalon, who dies for the love of Lancelot and comes downstream in a barge to Camelot to with a letter saying that she has died for love of him. This is not the same Elaine. This is Elaine, the daughter of the Fisher King. Because what happens now is a sort of almost a ritual marriage between Elaine and Lancelot. And he's represented that really by the grail in the background. Lancelot is now in his sort of fish scales, busy as the ferryman who comes from the lake. Elaine is veiled because she is the veiled priestess, the servant of the grail. And in Malory, he says that she put a spell upon him so that she looked like Guinevere, but actually I quite deliberately chosen not to depict it in that way, because I actually think the deeper story here really is the necessary union of Elaine and Lancelot in order for Galahad to be produced. And you can tell there's a sort of, so it's not, you know, not even an erotic seeming encounter. It's quite there's quite a sort of sense of stillness, quite a sense of reverence. It's like a ritual. It's like a ritual coming together. The next thing that we see here is, of course, she brings up the son, who is Galahad. And what she does is, when he is of age, is to bless him. We find he wears an equal-armed cross and wears a white surcoat. So again, we see the white and the red, but we also see the balance of the qualities of life and light, love and law. So he is the figure that will bring the grail back into activity, back into the world. And she, in a sense, in her blue robes, and she's got this ancient, quite blocky stone throne, which might, those of us know Egyptian tradition, might remind us of the throne of Isis. She's sitting between the two pillars, and the eternal light is burning over her head, another form of the grail. So what then happens is that Galahad comes to Camelot, and at the same time that he comes to Camelot, this red marble block floats down the river, carrying the sword of Balin. And here we see Arthur and Guinevere and the companions of the table witnessing Galahad, the High Prince of the Grail, draw the sword of Balin. Now, in drawing the sword of Balin in this way, this is quite a conscious echo of Arthur drawing the sword at the beginning of his kingship. In a certain sense, there's a way in which Galahad becomes called the High Prince of the Grail, and who himself becomes a kind of a spiritual sovereign, where Arthur is an earthly sovereign. And he is this figure, very like the figure that comes back over the hill, who brings the opposites together, and who can create, and who is at the service of the Grail and create new life. And so much so that he can take the weapon of destruction and wield that creatively. So the problem that we have in the destructive energy really of the sword of Balin, the energy of destruction and separation itself, is made safe by being wielded by somebody who is deeply committed to the Grail and to nothing else. The next thing that happens, the next thing that we see is the Galahad takes his place in the Siege Perilous, and no one else who has ever sat in the Siege Perilous has ever survived. They are swallowed up. In a sense, the people, it's that overreaching of yourself, because the Siege Perilous, in a sense, represents that commitment to working with the energies of Da'at. And if you cannot sustain yourself in Da'at, you fall, literally fall into the abyss. And we have here Arthur and Guinevere blessing Galahad in their ways. And there is, and this is really the beginning of Galahad's quest for the Grail. He is now the High Prince. He has drawn the sword from the stone. And now he makes his journey. And he has many, many adventures. But one of the things that happens before he sets out is the Grail appears in Camelot. And we see the three queens. In this case, Morgan, Elaine, and Guinevere, holding up the Grail, which has not yet descended, is not in the centre of the circle. The Grail appears while Galahad is in the seat. And it's like it impresses upon people the need to find and discover the Grail and bring it back to Camelot. And Galahad is the person who eventually achieves the quest of the Grail along with Sir Percival and Sir Bors. But the Grail Queens now are holding up the Grail to bless all the companions of the Daimon. Gawain goes on a great journey and eventually has a lot of adventures, which we'll come back to at a different point. But he encounters the ship of Solomon, which is a magical ship. And on the ship there is a great bed. And if you notice on the bed, there are around the bed, there is a framework. There is a red pillar and a white pillar and a green pillar. And these are called the spindles of the Tree of Life in the story. And there's and these, of course, are the two energies of the red and the white. And the green is the when these energies are balanced together, the green life of the Grail emerges. This ship is said to have been sent through time by Solomon, who at that point, Solomon was seen as the great magician. And Solomon had seen that in 1,000 years later, that the descendants of his line would need in particular the sword that is upon the bed, and would need the circlet that is the crown. And so he sends this ship through time, so that it comes to Galahad when he needs it. And the sword is a magical sword. It has a pommel made of many precious stones. It has two bones set in the hilt. This is the sword that overcomes separation. So it brings things into an unity. So it represents the unifying will, but it also represents the sacrificial will that surrenders itself to the deeper energies of the crown. And this is not the earthly crown of Arthur. This is the crown of Keter. This is the source of life. And so we see here that Galahad about to take sail to Saras, the Grail, the city of the Grail. And here he arrives at the city of the Grail and at the chapel of the Grail. And he attains the vision of the Grail. The figure holding the Grail is Joseph of Arimathea. And around we see the four great angels as shapes of light. So these are the four holy living creatures. They're not depicted as such because they're just depicted as light shapes. But these are the four holy living creatures who hold the throne that we find in the depths of our castle. There's no veil now over the Grail chalice, because Galahad is receiving the light face to face.
Sorry, who's holding the Grail? Yeah?
Joseph of Arimathea. Joseph of Arimathea, in the Christian mystery, is the person who takes down the body of Jesus from the cross and places it in his own tomb. And he is said to be one who collects the blood and the sweat of Christ. So this is how this sequence of symbols works. In the process of cleaning the body of Christ, he collects his blood and sweat into two cruets, two little vessels. And he's also said to be the keeper of the Grail. And he's also connected with the flowering hawthorn staff. So he's very much connected to the story of Glastonbury, because he is said, Joseph of Arimathea is said to be the responsible for the original founding of the first church at Glastonbury, which mythically is said to be the first Christian church ever established in this country. And so his legends are massively connected with all the Glastonbury legends. On Weary Hall Hill, there used to be a flowering thorn. This has been cut down by vandals. That is said, I mean, the original of which was said to have been established by Joseph of Arimathea, leaning heavily on his staff and plunging it into the earth when he reached the top of Weary Hall Hill and looking across towards the tor, feeling weary and leaning heavily on his staff. And within that moment, his staff is said to have rooted itself and become a flowering hawthorn. The Glastonbury thorn is, in fact, a strange variety of thorn that is normally found in the Middle East, and which often flowers at Christmas time. And there's a tradition that the branches of the flowering thorn are sent to the king, obviously the queen, at Christmas time. So this is a place really where the legend, Mallory's legends, really intersect with the legends of Glastonbury. And one of the principles behind this is you have Joseph of Arimathea coming from the east to the west, joining the traditions of the Middle East with the native traditions of the land. Hawthorn being this great ancient magical tree of Britain, and by him bringing his hawthorn staff and plunging that into the land and it flowering, there's a fusion of traditions. Similarly, the fact that he carries the cruets of the blood and the sweat, which are the two roses, they are the water and the blood and the tears, the water and the blood. Again, this is a myth of the fusion of opposites. But the Grail is all about the fusion of opposites and the new life that arises out of that. Talk a little bit more about that later on. But here, this is the moment really where Joseph himself, as the Grail priest, unveils the Grail to Galahad. As a result of that unveiling, it is not Galahad, but Sir Bors returns to. So there are three. We included Galahad just for the sake of simplicity, but there are three knights who receive the vision of the Grail. Galahad is the one who, in a sense, goes to Kettah. He becomes the transcendent prince. He is the high prince. So through his experience of the Grail, he does not return to to Camelot. In fact, he passes through the Grail into the direct experience of Kettah. Because, in a sense, the experience of the Grail is an experience of Da'at, the movement from the dual to the non-dual. So Percival, who is the next of the Grail seekers, has the same vision, and he opts to remain in the Grail castle as the teacher and initiator of the Grail initiates. And so he becomes a sort of like an inner teacher in between worlds. So Bors, who is married and misses his family, elects to bring the Grail and the Hallows back to Camelot, back to Britain. And so in this final kind of scene, what we see is the round table with the Grail at its centre, and the renewed Sword of Belin, now made glorious and shining, having now become the Sword of Light. And you'll see that the Siege Perilous is now open for anybody else who wants to undertake the quest if they feel it is right. But the Grail is available now in a way it wasn't previously available. But to attain the vision of the Grail means placing oneself in the Siege Perilous, drawing the sword from the stone, and following where the Grail leads, that the experience of the Grail appearing after Galahad had sat in the Siege Perilous, and then all the adventures that befall him are him following the Grail as it appears in different places, as it leads him on and on. And where it leads him to is an encounter with one of the great adepts of the past, King Solomon, who has sent to him a sword that represents this deeper consecrated will, that is at the service of the crown. And by accepting that, and by enabling that sword that is about the sword of unity and the will to become one with unity, that enables the vision of the Grail and enables then the Grail to be made manifest in a fuller way in the world, which is what we see happening here as Arthur and the companions of the Grail contemplate both the chalice and the sword. So, that's a very, very truncated, but I hope clear enough idea of the Grail story. The figure of, interestingly, the arms of Glastonbury Abbey itself have within it an image of the two cruets of the blood and the sweat representing the opposites. And in fact, in St John's Church in Glastonbury, there's a rather beautiful stained glass window of Joseph of Arimathea in a sort of a purple robe, which traditionally is the kind of robe of Melchizedek the priest, holding the two cruets, holding which again represent these energies of the opposites.
Can I just ask? I got the impression you said Bors bought the Grail back,
Yeah.
the actual Grail. I thought he bought the story back, and by his witnessing, sort of allowed its manifestation. I mean, the.
Well, Bors is the Grail, you've got to remember, is this mysterious thing. So it isn't that he just brings a story, he brings the real presence of the Grail back with him. So he becomes the Grail. So then we get, through the centuries, we get this sense of because the whole point about Bors in the story is he completes the Grail story by bringing it tangibly back into Malkuth. And remember, it's the Grail is not necessarily the cup. So the Grail, the one thing we can say about the Grail is that which does not regenerate is not the Grail. So he is the human presence who returns to his family, who is the possessor of something. Now, whether it's a quality within himself or whether it's an object, it's a mystery. We don't know. Something that heals all wounds, generates new life, creates new possibilities. And he is at the service of that. All three of the Grail Knights, because they are consecrated to the Grail in their own particular ways. So in a sense, Galahad surrenders his entire life and enters into communion with the divine in Keter. Percival becomes, in a certain sense, we could say, an inner plane kind of teacher, who is dedicated to the Grail Castle and to the teaching of the initiates. Bors is dedicated to the manifestation of the Grail on Earth. Any other thoughts or questions about that sequence before I move on?
These are the different levels in the tree, aren't they? Of eloquent peasant and shepherd king and Gerumar, are they?
Yes, so in a certain sense, it's the well. They both ascend. They all ascend. We ascend into the Gerumar place, but it's where they function from then. So in a certain sense, we would say that Galahad is the Gerumar. We would say that Percival is operating out of Tiferet and is the Shepherd King, and we would say that Sir Bors is acting in Malchut as the eloquent peasant, but they are all the Grail winners. They're all equal. It's just that their function is different. So, the function of Galahad is to be the Is to be united with the divine. The function of Percival is to be the mediator between the inner and the outer. The function of Sir Bors is to embody the divine and to bring that embodiment into contact with everything he touches.
And yet, Arthur's, where Percival is in the place of Shepherd King, and so is Arthur, yet Arthur is a king more engaged, so I'm quite
Well, it's a different no. It's a different thing.
puzzled.
So this is a different lineage, and a different task. So this is a different world where things had gone awry, had gone right. The Grail's crest would not be separated off; would have been integrally part of the story of Arthur. Now, because it all goes awry. In fact, one of the effects of the Grail Quest is to hasten the end of Camelot, because all the knights get very excited by the vision of the Grail, and they all rush off to, and most of them only, think of, like all the knights of the kingdom want to be Grail winners, not because they have the pure calling from the Grail, but because they just want it. And in a certain sense, instead of being able to fulfill their actual functions, which is to extend the principles of love and light, life and law, they want the transcendent experience at the center. So they abandon their duties, and most of them fail in the quest, and they end up, and lots of stories of them getting locked up and hurt and abused, and even Lancelot comes closest. But because of his love for Guinevere, he is allowed a glimpse of the Grail. But he steps too close to it and gets burned and thrown down. So that the effect really of the quest of the Grail is to hasten the destruction of the Round Table. And the because the, it, it's the this idea that the vessel cannot hold because the. So the thing that you find time and time again in the Kabbalah, in order for inner energies to manifest through a clean and clear and balanced vessel has to be formed to enable the energies of the transcendental energies of the spirit to manifest in embodiment. So, in a certain sense, when life and love and light and law are in balance and connected to the weave of Seruvial, connected to the great web of things, what is created is a balanced form through which the transcendental light of the unmanifest can kind of manifest and become embodied. But if that form is not balanced, that's, and that form is not secure enough, it shatters. And in a certain sense, that's really what happens to the round table. It breaks apart, and the and but and so the Grail quest, that for the in terms of the Grail winners, they're not integral to Camelot. They form a separate kind of stream, almost an underground stream, that and we'll look at this a lot more when we look at the book called The Perlisvo, where the where the which begins really with the realm of Arthur being in kind of chaos because of Arthur's slothfulness. And this is a book that's written in Glastonbury Abbey, and written really with a full understanding of the Glastonbury kind of legends, and the connection with Joseph of Arimathea and the inner aspects of the Christian mystery. I'm going to go into all that today because that's a whole huge thing of its own. But the so, but what you have, what Bors, so Bors is not an outer king. So this is not, so the Grail is at the service of the Round Table. But Arthur has not received the vision of the Grail. The principles, the hallows of the Grail are available, but they, this is not a round table and a king. So had the, if you like, this whole process happened as it should have, it would have gone up a notch. It would have gone a new iteration would have happened, where the knights and the king and the queen would have ascended to a higher level, would have become all would have become aspects of the Grail.
So the
Now that
perilous
doesn't.
seat, sorry, and the perilous seat and the king's throne have become the same.
Well, become the same. That's right. Yes, exactly. Exactly so. So this is, you see that kind of the, in a way, with this, the different stories, you see that split. And so the Grail remains available, and the Grail is sort of withdrawn but available in a in an underground kind of way, through the successors to Bors, through the inner plane contact with Parzival, through the mediation of Galahad from the place of the crown, but is in effect not available in the way it could have been available.
Ian, I think that there's a tradition of Gawain being a Grail winner as well, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. I'm going to come on to in just a
All right.
moment, really. But yes, so but
Preempting, sorry.
not no. There is a great that's no. That's great you say that because I'm going to just about to move on to that,
Spoil the
Marcus.
story now, Marcus.
No. It's a good
A
Martin. Well,
spoiler
Marcus has
alert.
brought it on
Spoiler.
in just the right moment because that's exactly what I want to go on to now. Because this because actually what we're looking at here is the is Malory. So the so Gawain is not a Grail winner in Malory. But the but Gawain is the right. I'm just going to show you. I'll not talk. I want to show you another slideshow, and then we'll talk more about it because this is the story of Gawain, who is both the who and Gawain is Gwalchmai, the hawk of May, whom we encountered in the meditation. He's also one of the great knights of the Grail, and there is an independent tradition, not in Malory, where he eventually does become the winner of the Grail. But there's a whole set of ideas around that. But before I launch into that, I'll do another share and show you the story of Gawain. Oh, figure I ask that again. No, not that one. No. Bear with me a second. I'm having a moment of where is that? Yes. Okay. Okay. Okay, so this is the story of Gawain and the Green Knight. This is an independent story. Not found in Malory. It is found comes from Middle English poem Gawain and the Green Knight, but it's also found in folklore. So I'm just going to talk you through the basic story, and then the rest of the afternoon I'm going to go through it because it's a central, absolutely central piece, really. But we start off really with. The story starts off with Winter Court, and the Arthur has this custom, which must have been very tedious for everybody around him, that he will not eat or let anybody else eat until he has seen a marvel, until something magical has happened. And fortunately for the hungry amongst them in this day, something magical is indeed about to happen. And the thing that is about to happen is that Morgan le Fay sends out the Green Knight, who we see here, who is this wild figure of the wilderness who carries the axe. The axe is archetypally the great symbol of the goddess. It represents the crescent of the moon. It represents also the gates of birth and death that they. For the goddess is the goddess of life and death. The green man has got the green knight has lots of find the green man image in so many of our churches. It represents the life of the earth, and so he does represent the life of the earth in winter and kind of and he is now setting off for the court of King Arthur. And here we have him breaking into the festivities. So here's this larger than life figure, waving his axe in the background. We see the snowy scene and the sort of the waxing moon, and the sense of kind of medieval worry and disturbance. And you see, it's like these energies. So it's a way that the primal energies of life. Primal energies of the universe breaking in upon the smallness of containment. And there's that great power of life, really. And what he does is he challenges the Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table to a beheading game. And he says, "What I would like you to do is I will kneel down before you. You cut off my head, and then in a year and a day you must present yourself to me at the Green Chapel, and I will cut off your head." Now that sounds like a good bet, doesn't it? Because you would not expect somebody to be able to survive beheadings. You might think, "Well, I'll never have to fulfill the other part of the game." But of course, the people at Arthur's court are wise to the the wily ways of supernatural beings, and so none of them want to do it. Arthur himself offers to do it, but Gawain, his nephew, says, "I will go in your place." And this is a very particular moment where he, when we were talking about the acts of Arthur, this is one of the acts of Arthur. This is Gawain acting as the substitute for Arthur and placing him in himself in the place of death and resurrection, killing and bringing to life, dying and coming to life. So this is really part of the whole process of this story. And this is all about the manifestation of the Grail. It's not using any cup images or anything like that, but it is showing us the sense that the same, again, the same imagery in and the same ideas and the different imagery, much as we find in the Corpus Christi Carol. So what happens next is that the Gawain, shown here with a crown circlet, began he's shown here as an image of Arthur. Indeed, cuts off the guy kneels before him, cuts off his head. Then the guy gets up and then gives him instructions as to where he needs to go in a year and a day in order to kneel at the and to play the second chapter of the beheading game. And in the poem The Grain and the Green Knight, you get again a very lyrical description of the passage of the seasons. And then there comes the moment, the time when, at winter time, the following year, when Gawain has to set out to the Green Chapel. Now you will notice that Gawain is in golden armour as Mordred was in golden armour. But we have here Gawain as the balanced expression of the archetype. Not the gold, not so, this is the, if you like, the pure gold of Gawain. And he bears on his shield the symbol of the pentagram. We'll talk more about that later. But the pentagram is the archetypal symbol of the human being. It's a microcosm of Vitruvius. It is the five senses of the human being. It's the image, and we cannot see it, but on the other side of the shield, there is an image of the Virgin Mary, because Gawain is the child of light, the servant who is at the service of the Deep Mother. And here we have, at the bottom of his hauberk, we have these sort of golden oak leaves, because he's also connected to this very ancient lineage of the sacred kings, who die and rise again, in order to bring new life into the world. Also has a helm with the two, with the red and the white in it. And so here we have him leaving Camelot, and he takes his time and moves away from Camelot. He rides through the Wirral into the place where the wild people live. And so it'll have particular meaning to Penny, because her husband Arthur is from the Wirral, the place where the wild, so the place where this is the place, Pen, where the wild Arthurs live.
Too true. Seconded. Yes.
He's riding through. And he doesn't encounter people, but there are all kinds of strange kinds of beings that he encounters as he rides off, and he's searching for the Green Chapel, where he's been given vague directions, but he doesn't quite know where it is, but he's trying to find it, and he has a long and difficult journey, and the. He comes at length. We find him coming from here, gallop on his horse, approaching the castle of somebody called Sir Bertilac. And this, you can see the winter landscape, the wildness. He's tired, his horse is tired. and he's relieved to find the castle, but he still doesn't quite know where the Green Chapel is, but he's determined to fulfill his vow.
Can I ask a question?
You can.
Who are his parents? You said he was the nephew of Arthur. Is it important we know
He
anything?
is the son of King Lot and Queen Morgause, who are kings of the King of Orkney.
Okay, that doesn't really mean anything to me, but we'll carry on.
It wouldn't mean anything to you because it's part of a much larger, well, thing I haven't filled in for you yet, really, about the different Arthurian houses, and so that's a whole other. We'll not get involved in the complication of that just yet, but anyway, he's somebody who was close to Arthur, and who, in a certain sense, is Arthur's substitute, right? Who is a, so he's a, and what that means, therefore, is he a sort of a sacred king figure. And that the whole of this story is part of the, is a similar story to the story of Galahad. It's part of the story of being the sacred king who brings the realms together. But rather like Arthur, this particular story ends in failure until it gets redeemed. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So he arrives now at the castle of Sir Bertilac, who is this slightly large, very ruddy figure, looks a little like Gawain. We have his lady here, who has a certain resemblance to Guinevere. And in the background, we have Morgan le Fay. So we're given a hint. Important hint that this is a subsection, a part of this larger story of the history of Arthur and the Table. This is a condensation, a particular version of that. And he's being greeted very warmly. He's welcomed in. He's very relieved. He's very tired. And so he now enters the castle, and in the, as an act of thankfulness for the, his safe entry to the castle, we see the green mass. This is a mass that is undertaken in the bowel, described as in the bowels of the castle, so deep in the castle. This is a very particular mass. This is the green mass. So we have the green Christ, the green priest with his antlers. We have the image of a man, the image of a woman with the two candles. So we have this again, this sense of opposites coming together. We have the dark lady and the bright lady. We have Sir Bertilac and Gawain, the older man, the younger man. So there's a sort of So there's a lot that gets constellated in this picture. In this particular story, Morgan is described as the old wise woman who's in the but who's directing everything. Now they feast together later, and he and Bertilac make a pact that so Bertilac is now goes hunting, and he says Gawain is intending to stay in the castle to rest, but they agree that whatever they find or whatever they achieve or hunt down in the course of their day, they will exchange with the other. So what happens there is Bertilac goes hunting, and Bertilac's wife seduces Gawain and kisses Gawain. And there's a mutual attraction. She's not ensorcelling him. It's just they're mutually attracted to each other. And you see the green chamber with the, again remembering that these are not people but are archetypes. So this we're in very much in the realm of Netzach, in the realm of desire. The flowers in the background. We've got the coming together of the red and the green, the opposites of red and green here. Which also might remind us of the green life of the Grail. The next thing that happens is a feast, and the feast they both exchange the gifts. So Gawain has been kissed by Bertilac's wife, so he gives this kiss to Bertilac. Bertilac has hunted down the crowned white hart, which he gives to Gawain. In the background, we have Morgan le Fay. Again, not as a young girl, but as an older woman who's from the back, behind of things, orchestrating the whole story. Now, the white hart is one of the great symbols of the Grail myth. The hart leads the knights into the forest Brocéliande, and takes and is and is the guide into mercy. In a certain sense, is the presence of Christ. And the hunting down of the hart and the giving of the hart to Gawain is in a certain sense a confirmation of Gawain as the person who is about to die at the sacred death and take the place of the crown, in a certain sense to be the crowned hart. I know I'm throwing a lot at you, so don't worry, all this is recorded. It'll be in the Zoom recording and we will revisit it. So the important thing is just to get the feeling of it, just to get the feeling of the pictures, which I'll send you all copies of when we finish. Because this is again a condensation of this story. And then this again, I've condensed this slightly because this over 3 days is a whole number of different gifts that are exchanged. She keeps kissing Gawain, he keeps kissing her back, he keeps kissing Bertilac. He gets given different animals at different times. But there is a final piece where she gives him her green girdle. Which, if he straps upon himself, she says, will make him invulnerable. And so this is a, and so of course he accepts this, thinking this is a good way to not have to die. And in the background, we can see Morgan le Fay witnessing this, and kind of wondering what choice he will make, because under the rules of the game, he should give this girdle to Bertilac. And in fact, he decides not to do that. So, in a sense, this is his failure here. This is the place where he decides not to enter into the mystery of death and resurrection. And because this is the night before he is due to go to the Green Chapel. Because Bertilac and his wife have told him precisely where the Green Chapel is. So now we see him riding up to the Green Chapel, but he's wearing the green baldric, the green girdle, because he didn't give it to Bertilac. And we see the figure of the green knight waiting for him. And what we see really is this: the Green Chapel is this ancient grave mound with Celtic carvings. It's that ancient womb of the earth. It's also the place of initiation. And so he is coming now to kneel before the Green Knight. But of course he's expecting to be okay because he has the green girdle. So now we have him kneeling before the Green Knight, who now is about to make his strike. It's a very solemn moment. But what actually happens is, instead of striking off his head, the Green Knight brings his axe down and lightly cuts him on the back of the neck. Now, this is a very subtle kind of moment, because he doesn't kill him, but it also demonstrates that the green girdle didn't work. Because the green girdle is supposed to make him invulnerable from any wounds. And so there is and he is challenged now because the Green Knight is actually Sir Bertilac. And in the poem, it's very interesting. The you make great use of this idea called entrelacement, where things are interrelated together. So the Green Knight is described as very, well, obviously very green. Bertilac is described as being very red, and red and green are complementary colours. So this red figure of Sir Bertilac, who now that they had the girdle been exchanged and given to Bertilac the previous night, a sacred ritual of death and resurrection would have happened, and certainly at the resurrection point he would have been given the green girdle as a sign of being the Grail winner who creates the around him the energies of new life. But in a sense, the girdle has no power. It is the form without the substance, because he has not given himself into the mystery. He sought to preserve his life as it is, rather than immerse himself in the changing life, in the changing possibilities. Now, of course, it's very easy, it's not at all easy to do. It's a great act of great heroism to submit to the new situation, the new energies, and to allow ourselves to be changed by that. But and this is where we come right back to this whole thing of one good custom will destroy the world. So if we ever try to remain static, we put ourselves outside the mystery, outside the changing, moving quality of life. And so the next thing that we see is him riding away in disgrace. He has failed. He has dishonored. He has dishonored Arthur. He has failed. He has failed in his quest. And the poor old horse looks a bit sad, but he has to go back to Camelot to confess his failures. Now, what doesn't happen to him, because he refuses to enter into the mystery, is he does not get to enter into the Green Chapel. into the place of the spirals and past the great gateways of initiation, into the encounter with the Dark Lady, into finding his place within the stars within the earth. There are a lot of echoes here of the figure of John the Baptist. John the Baptist is this is the saint who is beheaded in the He's also the saint connected to the fern flower, connected to the midsummer change of season. He's not a winter figure particularly, but he is the prophet of the wilderness. And not far away from where Steve lives, there's a place called Jenkin Chapel near the Goyt Valley. And this chapel was originally dedicated to Saint John the Baptist, because there's an underground tradition across Europe that connects John the Baptist with the Green Man, and with this medieval idea of the wild men and women, who are the wild beings of the forest. And you see some depictions of John the Baptist as a satyr with hairy legs and cloven hooves and being this kind of figure who represents the wild green life of the earth, because he's the desert prophet, the one who is the witness to the light, but who was another kind of priestly figure, but a wild priestly figure, connected to another figure you find in Islam called Khidr, the green prophet, who acts in this wild, paradoxical way. And who cannot be contained. And the beheading game is, of course, deeply connected to the story of John the Baptist, not directly through the stories, but through this sense of, well, the act, literal experience of beheading, and this. And there's a I'll show you maybe show you it later. There's a classic depiction of John the Baptist, where he's shown in a green robe, and with the wings of an angel, carrying his head in his hand. He's got his own head on his shoulders, but he's but it's an image that's not that dissimilar from the sense of the Green Knight. And the so there's a mystery here that's both pagan and Christian, that is about the other thing that's connected to John the Baptist that we find in the Anglo-Saxon Exeter book, is John is part of the Harrowing, Christ's descent into hell, and who and therefore goes into the underworld to free the trapped souls in the underworld. And in a way, this mystery that we're looking at here, which is the descent into the underworld and discovery of the accessing the universe, not by going up into the sky, but by going deep into the earth and discovering the earth as the gateway to the universe, discovering the stars within the earth. And in that experience, encountering the Dark Goddess, which is Morgan Le Fay in her deepest form, as the goddess of destiny, as the weaving goddess, as the transforming goddess.
Are there any connections to Brian and the second branch of the Mabinogi? I
Yes,
just
there
think
are,
death
yes.
and resurrection and
Yeah.
nurturing after death, death in life, that sort of thing.
All of that is in there. That's why the mystery of Bran is very connected to profoundly connected to all these stories that are connected to the Grail. I mean, one of the translations of the Grail family is Bronn, the rich fisher, which almost certainly is a corruption of the word Bran. But also Bran is also beheaded, right? So Bran is also the wounded king, the king who is pierced by a spear, and he is also the beheaded one, who then is the figure who is the generative head that creates life. So there's a lot of resonances of the second branch of the Mabinogi, read in conjunction with the Grail stories, is actually very kind of illuminating.
Is Morgan le Fay also like the new moon, the dark side of the moon?
She's like the dark, not the new moon, but the dark
The
moon.
dark side, because it is actually the it is actually the that exactly where we are right now. The
Oh, is that
moon
right? Are we in the dark
in
quarter?
new moon in 5 hours.
Oh, that's true, actually, because last night it was absolutely pit. It was a clear sky, but it was pitch. There was no moon in sight. Yes, that's interesting.
It's absolutely pit
No,
black.
she's absolutely the dark side of the moon, completely. And this is that place of the luminous creative darkness that is encountered. It is the transformative darkness that Gawain doesn't get to reach, and that's why he has sort of failed. Now there's a whole other now the story of Gawain doesn't end here, however. There is a whole kind of a story. And there's actually another poem called the Pearl Poem, which doesn't deal with the image of Gawain, but carries the story on, which I'll talk about later on to when after our, possibly after our break. But in the folklore stories of Gawain encounters the loathly lady. This is a lady who's described as profoundly ugly, and not by Malory so much. Now this is one of the other great stories, Arthurian stories, and she would like somebody to marry her. And Gawain, so she presents herself. And of course, they're all horrified. They're horrified by this, in a sense, by this terrifying dark face of the feminine. Again, remembering these are not people, these are principles. And Gawain is the only knight of Arthur's court who steps up. And this is a place where Gawain is described as the knight of the goddess. And so he is married to the loathly woman, the woman that everyone is frightened of, and who's said to be so repugnant that people faint or even die as she looks at them. And then they go to their wedding chamber, and Gawain is steeling himself for what is to come. But to his surprise, he encounters the most beautiful woman he has ever seen. And she says to him, "Well, you have a choice. I can be like this at night when you're with me alone, or I can be like this in the daytime when we are out and about and with people and at court. You must choose which shall I be?" And he goes through a bit of anguish. He, of course, would like her to himself and like to be able to intimately enjoy their connection together and enjoy her beauty, but also he would like to be with her with people when she's accompanying him on his errantry, or when they're with going hawking or at feasts. And so he moves back and forth in his mind, and then he understands something that he had never understood. And this is a surrender in him that has not happened in the story of Gawain. Because the problem in the story of Gawain and the Green Knight is he refuses to surrender. He doesn't trust the mystery. And here he trusts the mystery. He says to her, "Let it be what you will." He surrenders his will to her will. And this is a, it sounds like a small kind of thing, really. Well, that sounds like a nice thing, but a much smaller thing than it is. There's a huge transcendental thing in that he surrenders to the will of the goddess. That's why this takes us on to the final scene of this slideshow. We here we see the goddess, slightly larger than life, now blessing Gawain, consecrating Gawain, showing him the stars, showing him the mystery, showing him the green life, and making the and here finally now the green girdle becomes potentized, becomes alive, becomes powerful. And we have this, and we have the, and in a certain sense, he becomes this kind of solar figure where his strength increases as the sun rises, decreases as the sun sets. So he becomes this kind of sacral figure. So what I'm going to do now, if you don't mind, is I'm actually going to turn off the recording first. Okay, stop the recording. So what I'd like to do now, I'd like you to go into breakout rooms just to be able to talk. So I'm just going to put you in breakout rooms. Bear with me while I do that.
I think it's quite fun that because of the way we sit in our Zoom meeting, most of us look as if we've been decapitated. So it's quite appropriate. I was just thinking as I saw you doing that.
That's quite a nice thing, isn't it?
It's quite horrific, really. It could be a bloodbath, couldn't it?
Bear with me while I just get this together. Any questions about any of this while I'm sorting this bit out?
There are focus in the breakout rooms you want us to.
No, I think just to really, I mean, just to, I've just thrown a huge amount of material on you at you really. So it's really about, in a way, kind of, bringing up anything that you feel affected by, anything you feel confused by. Has it done that? Have we got enough people? Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4. Actually,
The
I'm not.
Corpus Christi image and then just talking about Gawain really seems to resonate very strongly with the Egyptian tradition, with the, Gawain as the solar hawk, the sort of
Oh,
horned,
very much so, yeah.
and then that image of the wounded king, the Osiris figure with the weeping Isis and the Anubis hound beside the bed is it, and the hawk that's flown over the forest to find them, and it so that does, I don't know, that bit in particular feels a real Egyptian resonance.
Oh, completely. In a way, it's kind of interesting, this, right? Because actually, if we think of this tradition having originated in Egypt and transmitted itself over time, when we get into some of the deep structures of this, you find these very powerful kind of resonances with Egyptian, in some ways, quite precise resonances with Egyptian tradition. So in a certain sense, Gwalchmai, who is the hawk of May. is the Horus Hawk. He's the connected to Ra, but of course there's this connection also to Osiris, who is the green barley god, the who also gets decapitated and his parts ripped apart, and whose head is kept at Abydos because that's the generative place. So you can see, this sense where ancient Egypt is the root of the Western mystery tradition. You can, even though it feels dispersed in a, it's in time and space, is very kind of direct, really. And in a way, that's one of the interesting things, I think, really, where if I think of my training, and Ernest saying that the servants of the light are an Egyptian school, although it's using Arthurian imagery. Of course, he's completely right, because he's drawing on these traditions from ancient Egypt, but using the dialect of Western Europe, the dialect of the matter of Britain. And then within that, we see that kind of, because if we think about the Book of Gates for a moment, which is a descent into the sun that becomes old each day, descends into the earth, descends into the mystery, goes into the deepest part of the night, experiences death and resurrection, and is reborn each morning. And the task of the initiates are to accompany the sun, to work with the energies of entropy. Because entropy is about keeping everything the same. So the great enemy, if you like, in ancient Egypt is Apep. So it's that this enemy isn't about death, it's about deathlessness. Because what the great serpent Apep tries to do is to ground the bark of the ship of Ra so it can no longer move. So it's about creating a static situation that just slowly decays, as opposed to a dynamic situation that is, of course, painful and difficult and shocking at times when horrible things happen to us. But if we trust that process of death and grief and the power of that purging process, what we awaken to is a new and different life. And in that strange way, we are made young again. There's that very powerful image you find right at the heart of Egyptian civilization, really, where the sun is a new sun every morning, is a young sun. And that summer, particularly those of us who got a lot older, that feeling, that newness, that brightness in our bones and in our, even though our physical body can't do the things it used to do and be full of aches and pains, we can still feel that fresh green life, that sense of possibility that arises. And I think what the story of Gawain and the Green Knight in particular shows us is, well, what happens when we resist that? And the great tragedy of Gawain in this is he just stays the same. Doesn't get killed, doesn't get even hurt. He's got a tiny little nick on his neck. And technically, he's fulfilled the vow, because he did what's said of him. But actually, he didn't get to experience death and resurrection. He just remained same old Gawain. And that's his tragedy in that story. And that's the bit that he understands later on in the story of the Lovely Lady.
He gets another chance, though, doesn't he? Like we do each day,
Well,
which
that's the point, right? So
is
that's the other brilliant thing, right? Is that's not the end of the story. So he has another possibility, and in the other story, he does the bit that he hasn't been able to do. He surrenders and gives his will to her, and in that act of surrender, he enters into the mystery, which is what that final slide is all about.
Because we need every chance we can get, don't we?
Well, I think that's the point in life, where fortunately we make mistakes all the time, but then another opportunity comes round. So
Did you
things are never too late.
I don't know if you said it at the end, Ian, but is it not the case that when he gives the lovely lady her choice, she ends up being beautiful all the time?
Oh yes, she chooses to be beautiful all the time. Yes, I didn't say that actually. That's true. So she becomes beautiful all the time. So the thing that couldn't have happened, the miraculous thing that happens, is that there is beauty in all places now, but couldn't have happened unless he had surrendered to her.
Yeah, that time he surrendered, but he didn't die.
Well, he did die. The part of him that died was his will, right? He had to surrender his will, and he trusted. What he didn't do, if had he trusted the experience, he would not have died. He might have been beheaded, but he would have been resurrected in new life. Right, so, and this isn't a lesser choice. It's not a lesser choice. This, he had to give himself completely to the lady. So something in him had to die.
So they have a new life, or something new comes.
Something new comes because he has been able to surrender. He surrenders to the goddess, surrenders to the lady. He enters into that mystery.
And
He
is that the end of the story?
well, that's the well. He goes off and does other things. In fact, he's always comes in and out of the Arthurian story, but he's the but in a way there is a kind of completion about that where he himself, as Marcus said earlier, is now a Grail winner. He is the center of life and life and energy.